Father, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing to you, and help us to love you and be who we're supposed to be for your glory. We pray. Amen. Okay. So we are starting a 4 to 5 part series from the preaching team on what it means to walk with God. I think the title is like having an personal effective walk with the Lord. And the series flow is going to start with, first off, who is God, which is, it's a 2-part talk. First part is today. The next part is next Sunday. And then Jesus as the express image of God. And then the next talk will be what it means to walk by faith. And then what does it mean to express God as believers in our daily lives? So each part is going to build on the other. And this is kind of a huge topic, right? So it's obviously not going to be comprehensive. But what I'm going to be doing today is going over the just the core truths that'll help us have a good foundation for our faith in knowing God and living that out daily. So I'm going to start out with just kind of a current global backdrop. And part of this, this section is probably about 10 to 15 minutes long. And the whole, if you want to go more in depth, I think I did a talk on progressive Christianity a while back that goes into more depth in other areas. So if you're interested in this kind of thing, that's a good talk to look at. It's on the website. So first off, last time I checked at XICF, we were an international church, right? So pretty much everyone I'm talking to has lived in more than one culture, been to more than one country. Some of us like 3, 4, 5, 6 different countries. And all of us have run into times where we realize certain things in our original culture aren't right, both factually and morally. And in this, at XICF, we are followers of Christ. And we believe that the way he describes the world and the way he says to live is universal, and it crosses cultures. Although that may be applied in different cultural contexts and look differently, but those underlying truths are universal. So this part of the talk is going to review kind of the main, I would say, the primary global cultural backdrop that we're living in, because this backdrop is almost like we're wearing these glasses that filters the way we look at the world. It filters the way we interact with the Bible. It filters the way we interact with each other. So the first of those filters I'm going to talk about is naturalistic scientism. And there's a lot of us here with academic backgrounds, graduate degrees in science or graduate level advanced degrees. And we're familiar with data and analytics and statistics. And the history of science, when science began, it began in a milieu of Christian thought in the Enlightenment, with the assumptions that because God is real and because he created the universe, we know our assumptions. We don't have to think about it. We know the physical world is real, and we know the physical world is coherent and is logical, and we know that our minds are reliable tools that help us know. And to understand the world as it is objectively is a worthwhile stewardship that brings glory to God and blessings for people. However, over time, since the Enlightenment, what's happened is what started out as theism, the idea that God created the world, he designed it, and he interacts with it. That idea, with the history of philosophy, turned into deism. And in deism, basically intellectuals, they decided that God set the universe like a big clock and he let it run and he wasn't involved in it anymore. And I think one of the driving forces behind that was God kind of got in the way of our desire to control everything, our desire to use just the scientific method, right? And then so, and in that process, empiricism happened. So empiricism taught that the only thing that was certain is what could be known by physical testing and experimentation through the scientific process and limited to your 5 senses. And when empiricism happened, then we didn't just go from theism to deism. We went from deism to what I would call either a hard agnosticism or atheism. And this is what became the religion of science, or what we would call naturalistic scientism. And it really is like a cult, like a religion. So basically, the physical world is all that's there, and meaningful discussions about metaphysics, so things beyond physics, were limited only to explanations with physical causality that could be tested and repeated by the scientific method. And this wrecked ethics, and it wrecked epistemology. Ethics is kind of the moral codes by which we interact, and then epistemology is the philosophy of how do we know things. And then, in addition to naturalistic secularism or naturalistic scientism, we have secularism. And I picked this graphic because it really is like one picture that does a great job of explaining secularism. So secularism is the primary influence in our politics and our public discourse, public services in most Western countries and most advanced countries even. And so my purpose in pointing out secularism is not to advocate for a theocracy. It's to show the insufficiency and the incoherence of this ideology. So I picked this graphic because it shows a hand. The physical, the flesh, the here, the now. In secularism, all of the faiths, the metaphysical worldviews are subjugated to the physical. And so a society can be organized so that, yes, we can allow Islam and Christianity and Buddhism and Hinduism and Judaism, so long as the core governance of a society and the core implementation of services is limited to the physical. So this principle, it's a separation of the church and state, right? The state from religious institution. It lets anybody follow any religion you want to, so long as you follow it in a secular way. But practically, this worldview is incoherent, and here's why. So think about this. What is public policy? What is a law? A law is a codification or a legislation of something that people ought to do, right? What is an ought? When you say you ought to do something, that's a moral command. Now, if you think about this for a second, what has happened is societies have allowed people or the core ideology to be an ideology completely divorced from the ability to know objective moral commands, to be the one that implements and executes moral demands. So we let people who have no metaphysics to legislate metaphysics. And so the result of that is relativism. It's the natural fruit of scientific naturalism and secularism. So why? Remember, we have to limit all your valid discussions to the naturalistic and empirical. So how do you know what's true? Our perception is a filter that prevents us from knowing the world as it is. Discussions of universal truths are an order above what we can empirically know. And so the result is, well, you have your truth and I have my truth. And I'm sure we've all heard that in some discussion or another. That's true for you. That's not true for me. Or that's what you believe to be good, not what I believe to be good. You do me. So truth now and morality now is a perception, it's a function of perception and a function of personal preference. And in this, the crazy thing is that our mind is now in this worldview is this merely a product of natural causes, chemical reactions in my brain as they relate with the natural world, and then this I guess epiphenomenon emerges, and I'm supposed to trust that as a valid guide to truth. So even our ability to trust in our minds as tools that connect us with an objective reality is in doubt. So in this context, it's in this context that, you know, if you look at what's going on in the U.S., what you call critical theory has emerged, that's really tearing apart U.S. culture and probably some other ones as well. So the way that works out is, okay, if you think about it, there's no more truth. There's no more right and wrong. And so now what do you have left? You have force. It doesn't matter what's wrong or right, what's true or false. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to categorize people in categories of those who are the winners and the losers, the oppressors and the oppressed. And then the oppressed are to take the power from the oppressors, and the oppressors are to release the power to the oppressed. And but actually, if that thing is logically worked out, what happens is you just have an endless cycle of conflict. Because you're cut off from truth. There is no objective truth. It's just these group of people who have their truth, those group of people who have their truth. And somehow we shared this assumption that justice is a moral ought that we're all going to buy into, but then we just have this churn forever. And I think if a culture runs down that course for a decade or two, it's just going to be devastating. So that explains a lot what's going on ideologically in the world right now. And then one other idea I wanted to discuss is kind of the Eastern Buddhist mentality. And part of the reason is because this is actually quite influential in Western society as well. So in Hollywood, there's an abundance of Buddhist type influence, whether it's Steven Spielberg or actors like Jim Carrey. And I think it's because if you claim to be Buddhist, so there's kind of an element of being, wow, thoughtful and deep, but also being materialistic, you know, so you're not bucking, you're not going against that cultural current of scientism. And the core truth of Buddhism, so this is a purported quote from the Buddha, is when we free ourselves of desire, we will know serenity and freedom. So the goal of Buddhism is to eliminate our desires. So in Buddhism, it came, historically came from Hinduism. And so the goal is kind of this enlightenment that's similar to the concept of nirvana, where you are one with the universe, the self, the observer, and the object are one. And that's kind of the Buddhist influence that's also, kind of tied into this postmodern naturalistic worldview that we're embedded in. Now, if you haven't figured out yet, these presuppositions, they're faulty. You look at naturalistic scientism, it divorces us from the supernatural. What's in the supernatural? There's God, there's our own souls, there's the souls of others. But even at its own foundation, it's faulty. So I mean, even if I were to tell you, if I were to say right now, like, I can't speak a word of English, you'd look at me like I'm an idiot, because in order for that statement to have meaning, I have to be able to speak English and you have to be able to understand it. So empiricism would be saying, okay, only empirically verifiable statements are worth discussing. But my question is, what about the truth of empiricism? Why? Why should I only accept statements that are empirically verifiable? Because that statement itself is not empirically verifiable. That, my friend, is a metaphysical statement. And you're telling me I have to believe it. And the contradiction is, if I believe it, it's not true. And then on secularism, it's kind of like the Tower of Babel. It's building a society with no metaphysical anchor for truth and morality. So I mentioned earlier, on what basis does a worldview that has no ability to define truth or morality objectively get to define it for the entire culture and subjugate all other viewpoints? So you get the result of that are atheist ethicists that are ultimately utilitarian. The end justifies the means. And they justify, if you look at human history, horrible atrocities have been done in this. And they'll keep going on if these are the anchors for society. And then in relativism, there is no one on the planet who can live out relativism. Relativism, by definition, is incoherent. I remember I mentioned earlier, if I say I can't speak a word of English, you're going to look at me like I'm crazy. So a relativist can't claim that their view of relativism is objectively true for every other person. Otherwise, what are they doing? They're claiming an objective viewpoint. So it's broken at a fundamental level. And also, if you've ever had long conversations with people who are relativists, the easiest way to kind of unveil the brokenness of that worldview that I found is I kind of play like I'm just not too bright, and I ask them to draw it out. And just man, I'm sorry, I can't understand this worldview. Could you draw it out on a piece of paper for me? And usually what happens is they draw out these circles that represent every other person. Like, this is his worldview, and that's his worldview, and this is her worldview, and their worldview. And they draw out all these circles, and everybody's worldview is there. And then what I do normally is I just draw a big circle around that. And I say, so you're telling me that this is true for all those people, right? So you're an objectivist. So relativism at its core is incoherent, and it's not livable. There's no single person here listening to me now that does not think there's someone out there. There are people out there doing things they ought not to do. And the minute you tell someone they ought not to do something, you are no longer acting as a relativist. And then finally, on Buddhism, Buddhism teaches us that desire is the source of evil. And the goal of life is to abandon that desire. But the truth is, when you think about it, does anybody really believe that? Is there anybody here that really thinks a mother and a baby at peace and health, and the mother delighting in that, is not a good thing? Is there anybody who believes a father wrestling with his 5-year-old boy and laughing and having a good time is not something to be delighted in? That romance with your wife of decades, a husband and a wife still being madly in love after their children are raised up. Is there anyone who doesn't believe that's a beautiful thing? Or a good day's work when you've done your work in your lab or your classroom or your office, and you've been faithful and the rewards of that come in, that desiring that is a bad thing? Or seeing your child make wise decisions for a future life of blessing. So the fundamentally flawed thing in my mind of Buddhism is that the issue is not desire as desire. The issue is that our desires as human are tainted and broken, and that we're fallen. We are in need of being healed. And it is the solution is for us to get a new heart and have our desires straightened and prioritize the right way, so that we desire appropriately what is to be desired in the right way. Jesus said in John 15:9, just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my, just as I keep my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be made full. So Jesus says, I'm telling you these things so that you have joy. Joy is desire that's satisfied to the full. Jeremiah 1:13 says, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. So the ideologies that we've talked about, that we have as societies, are basically ways that we try to organize the world so that we can be in control. And we don't have to revolve our lives around someone greater than ourselves. Psalm 50 says, I'm just going to go down. I'll just read a couple of them. Verse 10. Every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. In verse 13, he says, shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats? And then at the bottom, he says, in 17, and you cast my words behind you. These things you have done, and I kept silence. You thought I was just like you. So I put this picture, first off, I like dogs, but it's a statue of a dog. See, Psalm 50, this psalm is about people in that day making idols or following idols for exactly what I shared earlier, to maintain their self-rule. Now, these idols, in some sense, they were demonic in the sense that I think there's a demonic influence in this, but they're also just a mere projection of themselves. And these these fragile ideologies of idolatry, that are these fragile ideologies that we talked about earlier, they're merely a modern form of idolatry. So both of these, whether we're talking about in ancient days, mothers and fathers sacrificing their children to the pagan god of Molech by burning them alive, or in modern times, creating a system of education and governance that's atheistic and separates our kids from God, or perpetuates a whole industry of abortion for profit without regard to human life. Those things have the same root. They serve to structure the world around our own desire for control and power and lust. And they degrade us to a lower version of ourselves that is just not satisfying and not glorious. So what I'm going to do next, is my little tribute to The Simpsons, is I'm going to approach this the way a lot of, I think, effective Christian thinkers have done in the past 200 years, starting with Immanuel Kant. I'm going to talk about what C.S. Lewis calls the law within and the law without. So I'm going to start broad and then go narrow in this. So in early modern philosophy, Kant said two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and reverence: the starry heavens above and the moral law within. So there are two accessible books. If you're into reading this kind of thing, I can recommend three books. One would be A Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. That's a great read. He has a mentor, G.K. Chesterton, that's really great. If you get a hold of that, it's good. And Reason for God by Timothy Keller. The difference between these two books is C.S. Lewis has a set of assumptions that are early modern. So he's more classically liberal in the way that I think most modern Christians are. But The Reason for God is really good for the younger generation that has the more postmodern set of assumptions in life. So I found it a really good, a good book for young college students or people with those views. And then the last one would be Francis Schaeffer's as a trilogy. It's actually three books in one: The God Who Is There, Escape from Reason, and He Is There and Is Not Silent. And this one is just it's a mixture of apologetics and social commentary. But he goes through a lot of these arguments and just very, very eloquently. Okay. But one little note here is, I think back in my college days when I was studying philosophy, I was always in search of just these irrefutable proofs, like this way that I could just dunk on somebody who didn't believe what I believe, right? A real mature way to look at life. I've kind of come to the conclusion that in that sense, there is no irrefutable proof. And the reason there's not is because God made the world in such a way that our will or our desire plays a role in our ability to understand or know. Proverbs 1:7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and fools despise wisdom and instruction." So the posture of my heart will influence my ability to know truth. And I'm able to, over time, harden my heart to a degree that I am no longer able to perceive goodness or truth when it's right before my eyes. And Jesus, there's some pretty controversial statements from Jesus in Mark 4:11. He's talking to his disciples and explaining in parables. And he says, "To you is given the mystery of the kingdom of God, but to them that are without, all things are done in parables, that seeing they may see and not perceive, and that hearing they may hear and not understand, lest haply they should turn again and it should be forgiven them." So there's a sense in which even Jesus in his ministry, he was able to discern, he was able to tell parables, stories in a way that people's own decisions of hard hearts would filter out truth for them. But having said that, while there is no irrefutable proof in this sense, I think there is more than sufficient and abundant proof for people who are seeking to know what is true. And so that is very good news. And so I'll move on to the first part. Can someone just tell me that you're hearing me well and that I'm not just speaking to myself because all I see is my screen? So if someone could turn on their mic and say, yes, Rob, we hear you. I would appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, please, we are hearing you.
We hear you, Rob.
Okay, great.
Yes, Father Rob, we can hear you.
Okay. Great. All right. So this is called the teleological argument. It's the argument by design. And in my mind, this is probably there's two components of this. We're going to go small and we're going to go large. The teleological argument basically says that design points to a designer. So, and I'll illustrate it like this. Say we're walking down the road and we see a nice little rock, and it doesn't even have to have a hat or a smiley face. We see a rock. And then I say, hey, buddy, where'd that rock come from? And you're going to go, what do you mean? I'm going to say, how do you think that rock got there? And you're going to say, that rock's just there. And I'm going to be like, all right. And then we walk a little further and we see a stick on a rock. And I say, hey, how do you think that got there? And you're going to be, I don't know, a stick fell on a rock from a tree. And I'll be like, all right, you think somebody put it there? And then you'll say, maybe. And then we'll walk a little further. And then we see a stick on a rock with another rock on it. And then I'm going to ask you, hey, where'd that get from? And you're going to say, hey, that probably, I'm going to bet, if I had to bet $100 and I had to bet one way or another, I'm going to bet that somebody put that stick on that rock and the other rock on the stick. And the reason is because there is design. There is obvious and apparent design. So, so the crux of the matter is this. The universe appears to be designed so that if we investigate without a hard bias against the supernatural, this is the natural conclusion that we're going to come up with. And the irony is that when you read, like if you read, we're going to talk about the anthropic principle later on and argument by design. And it's funny, you read every single atheist philosopher or physicist or biologist, every one of them, they always kind of start their position with this. And here's a quote from Richard Dawkins from Oxford University. He says, biology is the study of complex things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. And so, to which I just want to say, thank you. Exactly. That's my point. That's all I want to say. So the principle is the more complex, the more we conclude it's done by a designer. And so if we were to take this and we're looking at rocks and sticks, and then we were to come across something like DNA, we were the vastness of difference in data and design is almost inconceivable. Psalm 139 says, you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you, and when I was made in the secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth, your eyes have seen my unformed substance. And in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when yet there was not one of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God, and how vast is the sum of them. So scripture echoes the truth of what I was sharing with the sticks and the rocks. And it echoes it to the point to saying that I am part of this grand design from a grand designer. And all the awe and wonder when you watch these naturalistic natural science videos, the sense of awe and wonder that we get when we look at this sea life or this microscopic life is not just like, it's not just to stop at looking at the phenomena. It is to expand in worship and glory for the creator, because this is marvelous. And if this world is marvelous and it came from a mind and from a God, how much more marvelous and glorious is it to know that mind and that God? It would be like if I was married to a baker and all I did is just delight in the cakes, whereas the baker is infinitely greater than any of the cakes. Here we have a picture of the Library of Congress. I don't know if you guys, I think I'm sure some of us here who are studying hard sciences know scientists now have been storing data, like actually writing data into DNA. And it's been going on since 2012. And under the current coding algorithms that they have, 1 gram of DNA, which is like the size of a paperclip, so 1 gram of DNA can hold 215 petabytes of data. This is showing my signal is weak. Can you guys hear me? Just mention on the chat if you can hear me. Just say I can hear you on the chat.
I can hear you on the chat.
Okay. All right, great. So 1 gram of DNA can hold about 215 petabytes of data. And a petabyte, that's the equivalent of 215 million gigabytes of data. So the printed content at the Library of Congress, which is the biggest physical library in the world right now, is about 1,000 gigabytes, so 1 terabyte, right? So that's 16 million books, 120 million other smaller publications like pamphlets, magazines, journals, legal publications, things like that. So if you take 215 million divided by 1,000, you have 215,000. Okay. So what that means is 1 gram of DNA can hold 210,000 Libraries of Congress worth of data. And that's only under current coding algorithms. It may be even 2, 3, 10 times more than that. Who knows? So we live in this universe when the natural course and order of the to degrade, law of thermodynamics, every chemical reaction and the data is, it loses more and more and becomes more disordered. So the natural flow is from order to disorder. And yet when we look at the world, the smaller we go, the more ordered it is, the more complex it is. And in my mind, it just seems like such an infinitesimal leap of induction to believe, okay, there's a mind behind this. So I am going to play. This is really cool. This is Michael Behe. I think he's from professor of at Lehigh University on irreducibly complex molecular machines. So here we go. Okay, guys, someone told me they can't hear the sound on this, so I'm going to try again. Can you hear it now? It's playing for me.
Yes, please, but we can't hear the sound still.
Oh, man. Okay, well, you know what? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. This is so... All right, let me try one more time. I'm gonna try something here. What about now?
Still no, no sound.
Okay, so all right, I'm just gonna narrate this real quick. So basically, if you can see the screen right here, this is a bacterial flagellum. The way this works is that, this structure, it kind of works like a mousetrap. Oh, yeah. Vera, please play that video. That'd be great. Vera's going to play it, and we'll see if it'll work out. If it doesn't, then I got one other video I'll ask her to play later on. If it doesn't work out, then we'll just scrap the video thing. Because these guys sound a lot smarter than I am.
The bacterial flagellum was one of the central examples of irreducible complexity Behe highlighted in his book.
If you take away the propeller, if you take away the motor, if you take away the clamps that hold it onto the cell's membrane, take away any of a number of different parts, it's not that the flagellum is going to spin half as fast as it used to, or it's broken. It doesn't work at all. It's like taking the propeller off of an outboard motor on your boat and wondering how far now you can go in the water. You can't go anywhere. So that's a problem for Darwin's theory, because Darwin's theory says that things evolve by working a little bit, you know, maybe not very well, but a little bit, and then a mutation, a change comes along that helps it work a little bit better, and that helps the organism survive and have more offspring. And so then another change comes along, and another, and it gradually builds up to the final structure. Well, that might work for some things, but it doesn't work for systems that are irreducibly complex, things like the bacterial flagellum. Because, well, if you wanted to build an outboard motor for a boat, what would you start with? Would you start with, say, just an iron rod that, you know, in the future would attach a motor to the propeller? Well, what's that going to do? It's not going to do anything. Would you start with just the propeller? Well, that's not going to do anything. It's not attached to anything. Would you start with just the motor? Well, that's not going to propel you anywhere. So with irreducibly complex systems like the flagellum, Darwin's idea is dead in the water, like a boat with an outboard motor that doesn't work.
Natural selection selects or favors variations that confer a functional advantage on a system. Many of the simpler versions that you could imagine of the bacterial flagellar motor perform no function at all. And so if you imagine trying to build a flagellar motor, adding parts one by one until you finally get to the complete system, you're going to encounter configurations of parts that confer no function, in which the motor simply will not work, at which point the evolutionary process will terminate. It will cease to continue because the system conferring no function will not be preserved and passed on to the next generation.
Okay, so this should go back to my screen now. Can you guys see my screen? Hopefully the next one will be a little smoother. Okay. All right. So now we're back to the PowerPoint. So basically, that's the idea of irreducible complexities. There are numerous small, they call molecular machines, that there are so many small parts that all have to come together at the same time. And the current mechanisms for evolution just simply cannot account for it. Really, the most rational way to look at it is a designer who designed it. This is one of the coolest molecular machines I've ever seen. And if you like this kind of stuff, just go on YouTube and search for Kinesin, K-I-N-E-S-I-N. And see those two little, there's like kind of purple pink globules at the bottom that are walking on this, it looks like a rope. This is crazy. So these little globules, they walk like feet. And this rope, it's almost like a sci-fi movie. This rope is literally constructed as they walk. It's almost like they're telepathically constructing this rope as they walk within the cell. And this structure, it's got three components to it. It's got the little globule feet, and then it's got these two legs. One is like pink and purple. The other one's kind of green and brown. And it's attached to this like fan-like feature at the back that basically, it's almost like a diesel truck. It just kind of grabs cargo and pulls it to places in your cell. And so the point I share all this is like, when you look at how complex things are now, and I took microbiology in college, which wasn't an easy course, and it's just amazing, like how much more complex we are here 20 years later. So this guy Michael Behe, his first book came, Darwin's Black Box, came out like in 1996, and then some critics came in. This is his most updated version. If you like this kind of reading, it's really interesting. You can find it on Amazon, and then there's the Discovery Institute link where you guys can find. So the bottom line here is when we look at the small, the complexity in order is just breathtaking. And so now, in Psalm 19, David says, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech. Night to night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, nor their words, and their voice is not heard, and their line has gone out through all the earth. So I'll stop there. So when we look at the universe with an open heart, it's giving us knowledge. So now, Vera, why don't you go ahead and play the fine-tuning video on slide 18.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result: no stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant. A change in its value by a mere 1 part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would, again, be life prohibiting. Or another example of fine tuning. If the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely.
Great. Thank you. And I'll share my screen again. So if you notice in that video, all those really smart, famous scientists are all saying, yep, that looks really designed. So let's move on to the second part here. Okay, so this is my little tribute to Homer Simpson. So now we're looking at the law within. And I think C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, if you scan this QR code, this is the online version for free. You can just read it online. So remember that backdrop of naturalistic secularism. So the common idea is that, morals are these emergent properties. They're not, they're subjective, and society gets together and figures them out pragmatically. And it breaks down with what does it mean that you ought to do something? What ought you do? So if we're limited to natural phenomena, natural scientific testing, when we say ought in that way of looking at the world, all you can really mean is if you want A, then try to do B. If you want a friendly neighborhood, be a friendly neighbor. But here's the core problem with this is that how do you know what should or shouldn't be desired as a basis for forming your ought? What does it mean for a human to flourish? For me personally, does it mean for me to flourish means I pursue whatever natural desire I have? And then you guys should conform your view of morality to what I personally feel. And that works for some things, but not everything. I mean, I think every serial killer thinks that, right? I think every mass murderer, not every, but some think that they're doing the right thing, right? People who do horrible atrocities do it because they think they're doing something that they want to do. That's good. So how do you do that from that framework? And why should we pick human flourishing over sea life flourishing? Why should I pick mutual flourishing over my own personal flourishing? So this is where those systems don't work out right. But the truth is that there are moral truths that are universal and that we all naturally know that there's something sacred about human life. That is it is a order of magnitude far above all other forms of life. And it's not just because I'm a person. We know, every culture knows that it is wrong to take pleasure by intentionally harming another person. And we all know that it is good to seek the benefit of others. And people who don't hold those things, cultures universally say, I'm not going to try to prove this to you. You're just wrong, and I'm going to put you in jail or have other penalties for you. So Paul, in Romans 2, he puts it like this. For when the Gentiles who do not have the law instinctively do these things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, so that they show the work of the law written on their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternatively accusing or defending them. On the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. So the biblical view gives the most elegant explanation for these moral truths, that they're deeply ingrained in you. They're vastly spread across cultures because they point to a moral lawgiver who will hold us accountable. So from an open look at the world and ourselves, we learn the natural world tells us that God is intelligent beyond our comprehension. He is vast beyond our understanding, and he is wise in how balanced it all works together. And my moral world within me tells me that there is a standard of goodness that I hold others to. And that standard is given to me from somewhere else. And I also, another thing is that, you know, Romans 7 talks about that battle within me that I naturally violate that standard. Even if you and I might disagree on what's right and wrong, even what you tell me is right, you don't do. That I need to be fixed, that something is wrong with me. Now, as we read Psalm 119 earlier, he was talking about marveling at creation. And the interesting thing about that is King David, right after he talks about the amazing natural universe, he immediately goes where? The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. And the precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. And the commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. So he goes from hearing God speak in the natural world to being drawn to God's revelation in his written word. See, there's only so much knowledge we can get about God from the natural world. But if we really want to know him, he must choose to reveal himself to us. So in the next week, next week's section, what we're going to do is, this is part one of Who is God? part two, we're going to take just a quick survey of the Old Testament and up until Jesus, and look at the historical narrative and the main characters, and what is God revealing to about himself in these stories? Adam and Eve, Abraham and Isaac, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Esther, King David, and Isaiah. And then we'll have a look at what God reveals about himself in Jesus. Now, why Jesus? John 17:3 says, "This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus the Christ, whom you sent. I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you've given me to do. And now, Father, glorify me together with yourself for the glory which I had with you before the world was." See, it's in Jesus that all of these stories culminate. It's in Jesus that when we look at the physical world and the law without and the law within, that meaning is culminated in full understanding of who God is. In John 1, verse 15, John says, John, that's John the Baptist, testified about him, Jesus, and cried out, saying, "This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me. For of his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. Now, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God, the Father, he has explained him." So this being that's so powerful, that creates the whole universe and vast to design such this immense expanse, and intelligent to fine-tune it with such crazy precision, and meticulous to create these tiny, inexplicable molecular machines. This God is also concerned for you. So concerned that he wrote his law on your heart. He wrote about himself in the stars and in your cells. And he's so good that he has been reaching out to us for thousands of years, changing the course of history. And he personally humbled himself to engage with us in the person of Jesus, and to be with us in a way that I think will, the more we know, the more blown away we are. So next week, we'll follow up on the second part of this. And in the meantime, here are some great small group questions. These are open-ended. So what evidence has been the most powerful for you personally when it comes to believing in God? What are some of the most beautiful, impressive, amazing things about the world to you? What morals do you think are the most obvious to everyone you met? Is there a time that God spoke strongly to you through your conscience? What'd you do? And then take some time and read these Psalms and share what they mean to you. So this talk, we're going to end it right here. And then next week we'll follow up, and there will be a lot more about Jesus, a lot more about the life that God has for us to live. But I think the beautiful thing about knowing God and being a Christian is that it's coherent. It fits together. We don't have to have this divorce in our mind from our careers and our scientific understanding of the world and our morals and what we read in a book that's God's written word for us, that it all goes together. And so with that, I'll hand it back to the MC. Thank you.